The good news is our state government's not going to shut down. The bad news is that it's barely a dent in, you know, facing up to the continuing problem we have.
Lawmakers strike a budget deal but leave a lot of work undone. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, June 23rd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, new ombudsman investigations show problems with the Office of Children's Services.
Virtually for every single caseworker we have who has more than the recommended national average of cases, it's an impossible job.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
The legislature avoided a state government shutdown by passing an operating budget yesterday, 8 days before the deadline. But they haven't addressed the capital budget or other important issues facing the state's future. To talk about this, I'm joined by Andrew Kitchenman of Alaska Public Media and KTOO in Juneau. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Laurie.
So what paved the way for the budget?
Well, throughout the year, pressure was growing on both the House and Senate majorities to avoid a shutdown. This is really getting pretty intense in the last couple of weeks. And that's not just for the effect on government workers, but for the impact on private sector jobs like commercial fishing. Both the House and the Senate showed a willingness to give ground. The Senate agreed to a budget including a smaller cut than what it had passed. This budget also includes a $9 million increase for school funding rather than the $65 million cut that the Senate had passed. The House agreed to drop a nearly $2 billion payment to fund schools in the future. But no one wanted a shutdown, and workers could breathe a sigh of relief today when the state officially rescinded their layoff notices.
And what about the permanent fund dividends?
PFDs are going to be $1,100 in October. That's $100 more than last year. But they're only half of what residents would receive under a formula set by state law. So it's the first time the legislature hasn't fully funded PFDs since the reduction last year came from a veto from Governor Walker. House Speaker Bryce Edgman says more PFD money could be added in the capital budget. But even if the Senate agreed to that, which is a big if, Governor Bill Walker could veto the money like he did last year.
Andrew, there's some major items the legislature hasn't passed.
That's right, Laurie. This year has seen the fewest bills passed of any year since statehood. Governor Walker didn't include anything but the budget in his call for the second special session last week. So the legislature hasn't agreed on a plan to balance future state budgets. I spoke with longtime budget expert Gunnar Knapp about where things stand.
The good news is our state government's not going to shut down. The bad news is that it's barely a dent in, you know, facing up to the continuing problem we have with our, you know, the imbalance between the state's spending and its revenues.
The Senate majority insists the state doesn't need new taxes. The House majority says they won't draw from permanent fund earnings without taxes, such as more taxes on the oil and gas industry or a broad-based tax like an income or payroll tax.
What else did not happen?
Well, there's no capital budget. The state faces an informal deadline of the end of September in order to benefit from federal funding.
Okay, so what's next for the legislature, Andrew?
Walker added a bill making changes to oil and gas taxes to the special session agenda late last night. Lawmakers and aides say informal talks could happen outside of Juneau in the coming days to decide how to handle the governor's request to consider the bill. But the two sides are far apart on the oil tax bill. And it's also not clear if Walker will add the capital budget to the agenda. Here's what House Speaker Bryce Edgman has to say about where things stand.
At this point, I think the legislature is going to stand down for some time, work with the governor. And we have more work to do on the capital budget. And I think the governor may at some point later on want the legislature to address fiscal measures.
We may know more early next week about whether the legislature plans to do anything more during the special session, which ends on July 15th, or whether it'll wait for Walker to call another special session later on this year.
All right, Andrew, thanks so much for that update.
Thanks, Lori.
That was Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reporting from Juneau. The state ombudsman's office has released reports for two investigations into the Office of Children's Services, both involving the same caseworker. Alaska Public Media's Ann Hillman has more.
In the first investigation, a father who lived out of state was trying to gain custody of his daughter. According to the ombudsman, the father called the caseworker more than 130 times to try to start a complicated interstate placement agreement. During that time, the 8-year-old girl was sexually abused by her foster father. The caseworker was alerted to the possible abuse by multiple people, including the girl's teacher and her counselor. But it was several months before she investigated. The foster father is awaiting trial for 9 counts of sexual abuse of a minor. In the second case, a baby was taken from her mother at birth about 3 years ago. The mother told the caseworker to contact the child's great-grandfather in Arizona so he could take custody of the girl. OCSE is legally required to try to place foster children with relatives first. Instead, the girl was placed with a foster family in Alaska. The caseworker was asked 27 times to contact the great-grandfather, but didn't for more than 2 years. She told the court twice that she had started the out-of-state placement process, even though she hadn't. Outgoing Ombudsman Linda Lord-Jenkins says the cases show that in the foster care system, failing to complete administrative tasks can have long-term impacts.
In both of these cases, relatives were very interested and took very proactive steps to try and get OCS to initiate the studies that could lead to the children being placed with them. And the caseworker didn't initiate them and didn't initiate them for long periods of time, despite the obligation and reminders to do so. And that's very distressing.
Since 2015, there have been 8 complaints against this worker. Lord Jenkins recommended that OCS review all of her cases to see if there are other problems. But OCS Director Christy Lawton says that wouldn't necessarily help because many of these problems stem from excessively high caseloads.
Which isn't to say that it's okay for there to be delays or, you know, untimely communications, but that is a reality when caseworkers are carrying twice or three times the recommended average, which has been the case particularly in our MAT-2 office for the last year.
Additionally, Lawton says the worker is now being overseen by a different supervisor. Lawton says with the high caseloads, more than 3,000 kids are currently in foster care, these types of problems are not unique to this caseworker. She says her employees are doing the best they can.
I think if we reviewed any number of cases, we would find similar problems where everything wasn't done to the T that it should in terms of every single policy, every single phone call returned, every single thing happening timely. It's simply impossible to do that virtually for every single caseworker we have who has more than the recommended national average of cases. It's an impossible job.
Lawton says OCS recently underwent a federal review, and the agency will be implementing the recommendations over the next few years to try to improve. Ombudsman Lord Jenkins says she hopes OCS will start examining how they handle different administrative processes to potentially prevent these problems in the future.
I would like the public to not lambast these folks who are doing the best they can with what they've got, but to also recognize that these things should not happen.
The state's ombudsman's office can only make recommendations. It cannot force any agency to do anything. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, anguish over restrictions for Kuskokwim salmon.
If we restricted everybody from buying meat, anything from the store, then they'd see how desperate we are.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Boating accidents happen, even to experienced boaters and on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make those you care about promise to be rescue ready by always wearing a life jacket when in an open boat or on deck, attaching the engine cutoff device when underway, and carrying emergency communication and distress signaling devices on their person. Visit pledgetolive.org for more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
It's shaping up to be another record low year for king salmon on the Kuskokwim. Halfway through the run, results from the Bethel test fishery show king salmon numbers similar to 2012 and 2013 when the kings crashed. People in the region remember those years as the lowest ever recorded, with each year bringing about 100,000 kings and tight regulations. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports.
All right, let's look at the agenda.
The state Fish and Game Department shared those low numbers at a meeting on Wednesday in Bethel. Attending were a group of Kuskokwim residents who advised the state on salmon management. The news to the standing room only crowd and to those participating via phone did not come as a surprise.
Traditionally, by now, over half my fish is in my smokehouse, smoking.
Walter Jim is president of the Bethel ONC tribe.
But if you look across the river or any of these fish camps in these sloughs, there's no smoke coming out of these smokehouses. You know, I prepared my fish camp for nothing.
There hasn't been a gillnet fishing opening on the Kuskokwim in over a week and a half. That's when the feds took over management of king salmon from the mouth of the Kuskokwim upstream to Aniak, and gillnet fish openings before then were sparse. Frustrated, residents sent a clear message to managers at Wednesday's meeting.
Let us fish.
Ivan traveled from Aniak to attend. He said without fish, people were in, quote, mental anguish.
We are fish people. We need fish. They're desperate right now.
The meeting featured special guest Hazel Nelson, the director of the Division of Subsistence, and Sam Cotton, the commissioner of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. To these visitors, Sandra Nicarai of Gweethluk tried to convey the importance of salmon to Kuskokwim people, comparing it to shopping for food in a city grocery store.
If we restricted everybody from buying meat, anything from the store, then they'd see how desperate we are.
Others worried that the Bering Sea pollock fleet was catching king salmon headed to the Kuskokwim as bycatch. Some also had concerns about the way the state collects salmon numbers. And the question asked again and again, what will people eat during winter if they're not getting enough fish during summer? State Commissioner Sam Cotton said their concerns were not falling on deaf ears. However,
I'd be remiss if I didn't say that, you know, one of the primary responsibilities in my job and with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game is to protect the fish, to make sure we get escapement, that we don't overfish.
Then he asked regarding Kuskokwim kings.
Who else is going to bear that burden of conservation besides you?
Why the king salmon numbers are so low, managers say, is still unknown. But they do know that kings mostly return to the Kuskokwim as 4 to 6 year olds, and the parents of this run's 4 and 5 year olds were part of the 2012 and 2013 crash. Those years, the kings did not meet escapement goals the managers felt were necessary to replenish fish stocks. Many kings did not reach their spawning grounds. General unrest filled the tightly packed room. Ken Stallnecker with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service says they've seen fishermen complying with the restrictions so far, but federal law enforcement in the area has told him they don't think it can last.
They have been sensing more resistance, more interest definitely in getting out.
Federal managers will be meeting with the state and the Kuskokwim River Intertribal Fish Commission on Friday to consider opening a gillnet opportunity. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
Unlike the Kuskokwim, Yukon River King and Summer Chum salmon runs are shaping up to be some of the strongest in years, but not strong enough for a commercial harvest. Fish and Game sonar project on the lower Yukon at Pilot Station estimated about 25,000 kings and 280,000 summer chum on Wednesday alone, some of the highest daily passage numbers seen over the past 10 years. Fish and Game Yukon River summer season manager Holly Carroll says the Yukon King Run is on track to come in at the upper end of the department's preseason projection, but it will likely fall short of the huge king runs of the 1980s and early 90s.
run sizes used to be about 300,000. So if we see a run size of 190,000 this year, we're definitely happy, and that should be sufficient to meet escapement goals. But there have been restrictions on subsistence fishing. So we aren't out of the woods yet. We're still sort of in conservation mode, but we can certainly be hopeful right now.
King salmon management on the Yukon over the past few years has focused on protecting the first pulse of fish, many of which are bound for Canada. Any subsistence fishing opportunities for kings have been provided near the end of the run. Commercial fishing for Yukon king salmon has not occurred since 2007, and no commercial king openings are planned for this year. Commercial fishing for the Yukon's abundant summer chum salmon is happening with selective gear types only. Earlier this month, the Coast Guard pulled a man, his dog, and a makeshift raft out of Gastineau Channel. There's a little more to the incident. KTOO's Jacob Resnick has more.
It was his day off, and Coast Guard Lieutenant Joey Schlosser was standing in his kitchen. He has a nice view of Gastineau Channel, and it was a beautiful sunny day.
I was making breakfast and noticed something coming down Gastineau Channel from Sheep Creek towards the house, and it looked like a kayak at first. Like, I don't know what the hell that is.
As he got a better view, he decided he'd better call the office.
This is going to be kind of a funny phone call. So I'm at home,
yep.
And I've got stuff going by my house in Gastineau Channel.
Okay.
On what looks like a makeshift float out of duct tape and God knows what else.
His concern was for 32-year-old Brant Smith and his black dog, Sam.
He's paddling away right now, but this thing is janky as hell.
My original plan was to get somewhere kind of off the beaten path and build like a log barge that I can pull behind me on low tide so I can walk along the shoreline. And then I was at Fred Meyer's picking up some last minute supplies and so on and so forth. And they had this sale for these small little inflatable rafts.
Well, I'm a search and rescue controller here in Juneau. So, you know, I'm looking at something that just doesn't look inherently safe. What kind of set my, I guess, sensors off was a barge went by. And then once the wake caught up to him, he got waked out pretty good.
I was trying to get down a little bit past Snettisham.
That's a fjord about 30 miles south of Juneau.
I mean, I was going to try to modify the little inflatable raft as I went because it was going to take me a few days, maybe even a week, to get down there with the raft. But that kind of didn't really pan out.
The Coast Guard launched a 25-foot lifeboat at about 2 p.m.
When I saw the orange-bowed Coast Guard thing, I was like, oh, crap. They were trying their best, figuring out ways of maybe trying to tow me down there or get me down to where I wanted to get to. I mean, they really tried.
And, you know, up here in Alaska, if someone's trying to go somewhere that's pretty far out and, you know, visually you're taking a look around and you don't see proper safety equipment, then, you know, then that's where, you know, we tend to intervene.
The Coast Guard crew loaded Smith, Sam the dog, and the makeshift raft into their boat and took them across the channel to Douglas Harbor. So who is this Brant Smith, and what was he trying to do?
I was planning on going out there and making myself a little kind of home away from home area where I can grow some food and maybe have a small little inconspicuous little house or something. And I used to be a helicopter mechanic. Kind of got burnt out on working on helicopters, got burnt out on pretty much everything. Kind of saw the world as a bleak side of life where it's like all you're doing is paying to live.
He's since set up camp outside of town and says he's already got his cold weather crops in the ground. He says his goal is self-reliance.
Hopefully, if I keep myself quiet enough and not make a nuisance of myself, I mean, hopefully where I'm at, I can be left alone. But I just don't want to become another homeless person in the city of Juneau because there's only two ways out of this freaking town, one by air and one by boat.
And he's already tried the boat. In Juneau, I'm Jacob Resnick.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com. And by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
K-T-O-O.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, leopards, otters, and bears.
Oh my.
In the last 5 decades, the Alaska Zoo has dramatically transformed. Its origins are with an Anchorage grocer who won a baby elephant in a contest. That elephant was kept in a heated stall at a horse ranch, and over the years, a zoo grew around her. But the process of expanding a collection of rare animals isn't easy. And as Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes found out, it combines some nonprofit budgeting with the whims of Mother Nature.
A mama muskox named Maya chomps on branches while her tiny new daughter nibbles on a pile of fireweed.
This one was born here, and her name is Sarah Elizabeth.
Patrick Lampe is the zoo's executive director, and he says of all the ways they acquire new animals, births like this are the rarest.
We have a pretty limited breeding program here. Muskox, we know there's a need for them.
What Lampe means is that a lot of zoos around the world want a muskox. And although zoos can't sell animals back and forth, there is a sort of global exchange. The last muskox born here was sent down to a zoo in Tacoma. But the majority of new animals come through rescues, including a different baby muskox just a few feet away. This one tinier and so young, he hasn't even been given a name yet.
Oh gosh, what is he now? I think he's pushing a month now. Not too much bigger than a newborn. This was a pretty small one. It was orphaned from the herd in Nome, and they actually tried to get it back with the herd, but they kind of rejected it.
This knee-high ball of fuzz braves a slight drizzle and silently trundles closer and closer to us.
And no petting, right?
No petting.
When this muskox gets bigger and healthier, he'll be sent to live up at the university in Fairbanks. And that's a lot of what the zoo does with injured and orphaned animals. Basically provide foster care until they can be placed in a permanent home. Lampe says in Alaska, there are some species this happens with so often, they'd never think about trying to breed them in-house.
Like brown bears or black bears or moose calves. There's usually so many orphans that there's really no need for us to be breeding those. It's better to try to find homes for the orphans that are out there.
We head to the other side of the grounds to go see one such luckless little cub. But on the way, we get sidetracked by a pack of wolves.
They are all from one litter.
The five wolves are from an area outside McGrath, where there was a lot of predator control. Lampe says the zoo went to the state and basically said, look, we can take some of these wolf pups out of the area. That's a win-win for both of us. And the state said, okay. That was 11 years ago, and the pack is now a fixture at the zoo.
Come on, you guys can do better than that.
And in front of a group of kids, Lampe nudges the wolves into a performance, like some kind of choral director. Even though Lampe's been working at the zoo for 31 years, he still stops to listen every time the wolves are howling. We head down a side trail to see a tiny little black bear that was orphaned in Valdez this winter. Eventually, it'll head to the San Diego Zoo, which is lucky because Lampe and his staff can only take in animals when they know they can find them a permanent place.
There's no way we can take care of them for the rest of their lives, and we don't have a home for them to go to, then they let nature take its course out in the wild.
Afterwards, we walk by a trio of playful otters, pass an owl and some damp yaks, and wind up in front of the snow leopards. These animals are extremely rare. The female, Malala, came from a zoo in New York this May. The couple is napping on rocks, separated by a thin chain link fence.
Do they get along?
They're still checking each other out.
Like every other zoo, this one has a wish list of animals they're looking for. And an acquisition like Malala's is the last way that a collection expands. It's more common than births, but less frequent than taking in orphans from the wild. It's actually sort of like working with an adoption agency to find a match. For months, the two zoos exchanged information, assessed options, and coordinated logistics.
You know, animal like a snow leopard, it had to fly on FedEx and have two people travel with it.
Since Lampe took over as director, the nonprofit zoo's budget has doubled to about $3 million. But that hasn't gone to expanding the site's footprint in South Anchorage. Instead, the growth has been mostly in improving animal habitat and adding staff, particularly educators, to work with visitors. Lampe says it'd be nice if they could get money to buy up new land and add some weasels, more leopards, and maybe a rare Chinese goat called a takin. But his priority is fixing up more of the facilities on site and growing the zoo from within. For AK, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week we're hearing from Nané Bocart from Anchorage. Bocart is originally from the Netherlands and has lived in Alaska for 5 years.
I went to study Colorado School of Mines 2 years before that, where I met a girl who graduated that year and then moved up to Alaska. So I followed her 2 years later. I'm a student nowadays again, since a month ago. Before that, I was an engineer. And I was dissatisfied with my profession, so now I want to become a teacher. I worked at Endicott, and that's a very large difference in view. Most of the operators up there, I think, are very like-minded. And in town, not the same as the ones on the slope. Everything goes more out of a... Because I work with engineers, so people have a little bit more of a sciencey approach to everything. So it's not just like a standpoint is a standpoint. You can debate everything, and you have to kind of... We can talk about stuff and like pull in some research and that kind of stuff. And it's a way more multicultural environment because the engineers that I work with work from all over the world. And like, so that's a big difference. I've been to Norway a lot, which is fairly similar. It's just, this is like a rough Norway, I think. Like we're still, things are still wilder. Well, Norway has all the nature. It just all feels more civilized. It's more structured. I think there's more trails. There are like huts. The nature's still very pretty, but here you got bears, you got moose. They don't have the wildlife and stuff. I like the freedom you have here to go in the mountains after work. You can just 20-minute drive and you're up in the mountains. In winter, you can ski everywhere. It's something you can't see anywhere else.
Nané Bocart lives in Anchorage. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Zachariah Hughes, Henry Leisha, and Wesley Early. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman and Jacob Resnick in Juneau, Dave Benninger in Dillingham, Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, and Tim Bodoni in Galena. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Sean Dugan is our editor and producer. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaskans and in the 40 years of Alaska operations. Alaska Pacific University works with students to maximize their credit transferability and give credit for prior work experience. At APU, your path to degree completion is outlined right from the start. Learn more at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.